You can meet and hear Mark and Molly Hemingway, Robert George, Brian Wolfmiller, Larry Rast, and Will Wheaton at the 2021 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Making the Case is Friday, July 23rd and Saturday, July 24th at Concordia University, Chicago. Early bird registration is $135. Learn more at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. Making the Case, July 23rd and 24th in Chicago. People are slowly catching on, coming to realize that, and maybe the pandemic made it more evident to us because we actually got to see as parents what our children were being taught day to day because of remote learning. And parents are catching on. They're seeing for themselves that some of the ideas that they really didn't want their children to imbibe, their children have already imbibed in the classroom, sometimes from a very early age, but especially in our public high schools, this woke ideology. Now, is the public school system a lost cause since woke ideology has permeated every subject in the classroom and since it's already had an effect on at least half a generation of high school kids? Does it account for the militancy of the younger generation? Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're going to talk about woke ideology in public high schools. Josh Pauling joins us. He's been teaching high school history for 13 years. He's head elder at All Saints Lutheran Church in Charlotte, North Carolina. And he's author of a recent column titled The Look of the Hunted in Today's U.S. High Schools. Josh, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thanks, Todd. It's a privilege.
Tell us your story. Why are you leaving teaching public schools?
Right. So I've been teaching high school history for 13 years, as you said, at a fairly large, diverse high school in the South. And I would consider it a pretty normal public high school. And to be fair, it's been a great place to work. I treasure my colleagues and administrators and have greatly benefited from my time there. It's also given me an insider's look at the school system. And in many ways, sort of as an undercover detective, you might say. And many pundits comment on and critique about the issues public schools face, but I've sort of lived them out every day for many years now. And in some ways, it's better, and in some ways, it's worse than what the pundits say. So there's a lot of factors why I'm leaving, but I would say at root, I've come to the conclusion that the foundations of the system are faulty. The assumptions about how students learn, the nature of the human person, the nature of truth, all those things that are sort of built into the system are incorrect presuppositions. And when you see that the foundation of something is faulty, I've decided that my efforts could be more impactful outside of the system. And maybe to put it another way, I've come to the conclusion that there is no such thing as neutral teaching. And I think this is something that everybody needs to realize. Public schools are not neutral institutions. I think a lot of people have been lulled into believing that. And I know I started my career thinking that way, that I'm going to be a neutral teacher. I'm going to sort of shoot straight down the middle and show both sides of issues and so forth in my history classroom. And the more I've got more experience and reflected on that, it's impossible to be a neutral teacher. You're constantly making decisions about what to include or exclude, how to frame issues, and all those things are not an unbiased process. And so I've concluded that I'd rather be in an environment where I can explicitly teach from a Christian worldview and really come to realize that if there's not explicit, clear teaching to counter the mainstream narratives, then those positions will win hands down. The forces of culture are that strong.
You cite Richard Weaver's phrase that the typical modern has the look of the hunted, and you apply it to today's woke adolescents. What do you mean?
Right. Yeah. So I take this quote from Richard Weaver's 1948 book called Ideas Have Consequences. This was written on the heels of World War II. It's a classic prophetic piece of cultural analysis. It's sort of a must read, especially in conservative circles. And in the book, he says this, quote, "The typical modern has the look of the hunted. He senses that we have lost our grip on reality. And this in turn produces disintegration and a fragmentation of our world picture." And he wrote that in 1948, and it seems to have come more true with each passing year. So I use that phrase, the look of the hunted, sort of as a launching off point to explore what we're seeing today in schools and with adolescents.
What does Weaver mean by disintegration?
Right. So he uses this word a lot in the book. He uses disintegration and fragmentation. And by that, he means there's no unifying center. There's no unifying principle for a worldview. He talks about this leading to meaninglessness and powerlessness. He says the meaninglessness comes about because there's no center, there's no transcendent truth or objective reality. And then he says that also leads to powerlessness, because with no meaning, then that easily transfers into no power, that we're sort of acted upon rather than acting. And the look of the hunted is a good way to capture that, right? Anxiety, nervousness, jitters, fears, lack of purpose, alienation, all of those things that are so evident, especially amongst young people right now, as all the data and statistics continually show.
So what signs of this look of the hunted do you see in students?
Right. So I see the meaninglessness and powerlessness especially come up a lot. In my history classroom, we certainly engage in discussions about moral issues and in issues of historical importance, maybe more so than obviously a math class or a science class, etc. But what comes up in those discussions is many times students don't have any grounding for their opinions on moral issues. It's just their opinions or their feelings. There's no sense in which there's a larger objective truth or a framework for the world that they've placed themselves within. And so they're sort of aimlessly wandering. So I see that with their opinions on moral issues and lack of grounding for those opinions. And then also just a general lack of purpose or goals, right? When there's no goal to the universe, personal goals also many times get lost. Granted, they might have some abstract idea of going to college or making money, but those are vague, sort of nebulous goals that don't really get to the heart of the human experience and human flourishing. The powerlessness I see come through in increased anxiety. Students, more and more the last several years, I've noticed a marked increase in students who are just really nervous, even in class. Even many coming up to me after class and saying that they struggle with anxiety and don't want to contribute. And that's something that's concerning for sure.
So how has this meaninglessness and this powerlessness led to what you call my truth or else militancy?
Yeah, this is an interesting development. So the idea of the look of the hunted is that you're nervous, you're anxious, you've got jitters, you've got fears, meaninglessness, powerlessness. But what we're seeing now is a shift from that sort of relativistic, apathetic experience to a much more militant approach, where the hunter, we might say, is becoming the hunter. And it's an interesting twist. And I see it come through in especially a few things that I've done as assignments throughout my career. But in the last few years, I've seen an increase in these types of responses. And so one of the assignments that I see this come through is an assignment we do on Christopher Columbus. And I have my students read some primary and secondary sources about Columbus, and we engage in discussions about his legacy and how we should remember Columbus. But the most common conclusion that students have nowadays about Columbus is that he was, quote, a very bad person, right? And that's an interesting conclusion, especially for those who at one point were claiming to be relativists. On what basis are they determining that he is a bad person? Right. So that's a little evidence of this shift. And then also, I do an assignment when we're talking about the American founding, where we read some primary sources from Federalist Number 10 by James Madison specifically. And I ask my students, what actions are justified in protest against the government? And this year especially, I noticed a significant increase in the number of students that responded that violence could be necessary and would be acceptable to achieve political ends. And that certainly is another example of this shift from a more relativistic, sort of apathetic view to a more militant approach to things. And certainly the data also bears this out. There's been several studies that have been done that have shown on both the left and the right an increased willingness to use violence politically. And certainly we don't have to think too far back in the last year to see evidence of that on both sides.
How do students reconcile this militancy, this kind of, you say, even kind of a doctrinaire fundamentalist view of their truth with their belief that, as you said, truth is relative?
Yes, this is the big conundrum. And I think there's a few things at work. One is logical consistency to the postmodern isn't the most important thing. So raising that point might not get you very far with the average student. But second, I think what's interestingly happened here is that sort of in an interesting twist, postmodernism's deconstruction of truth and narratives and sort of the ascension of moral relativism in years past has left room for now a sort of a new ascension of one remaining narrative that's taken as capital T true. And that would be the narrative of the oppressed and the oppressor, power dynamics, especially as they play out along identity categories, race, gender, and sexuality lines. That's really the one category left, victim and victimizer, powerful and powerless. And this is the lens through which everything is viewed. So it's sort of an interesting twist, and I'm not sure exactly how to crack that nut, but I think part of it is postmodernism in its sort of rejection of truth overall has left this one area of truth remaining, and that's the lens of power.
So overall, what is the woke worldview? How would you describe it?
Right. Yes. If I could summarize it in sort of one sentence, I think I would say that it is viewing the world through this lens of power dynamics, that everything should be viewed through this lens that puts us into groups or categories based sometimes on external things like skin color or biology, but then also sometimes based on internal things like one's gender identity or one's self sort of constructed category.
Have you seen woke ideology work its way into the teaching of history?
Yes, definitely. It's a great question. There are so many ways that it works out in teaching history, especially because you're dealing with these questions of race, of economics, of class, of gender. And so for many years, it's sort of been brewing, you might say, and it's certainly come to a head in the last year or two. So in some ways, it's not new. You could go all the way back to Howard Zinn with his famous A People's History of the United States written in the 70s, which has been a staple for years and really is an early form of what we're seeing now. For years, textbooks have more and more focused on the lens of race and gender and class, sort of as the framework to understand the past. And then more recently, we see things like the 1619 Project, certainly with the New York Times, and then also the recent increased push for increased civics education since January 6th. But as many have pointed out, this new form of civics that's being put forward is more about activism than about civics education traditionally understood. Now, if I may, in one sense, actual teachers may be slow to implement these changes, and some teachers never will. So I think we need to be fair to the average teacher in the system that, you know, many of my colleagues have no desire to teach the 1619 Project or any of these other, you know, sort of identity-driven histories. But even if the individual teachers don't implement those changes without explicit teaching to the contrary, then those narratives went out. And again, I think that is something that everybody needs to realize and wake up to, that even if a teacher attempts to be neutral and may not want to implement the 1619 Project or Action Civics or any of these other things, the fact that there's things left out and that there's no explicit counter to these things really is the problem. And over time, then those narratives, progressivism went out if there's no sort of countercultural catechesis going on, right? Because we're constantly being catechized into these things well beyond the classroom. The real catechesis takes place on the screen and online and in the media and all of those things that are really buying into these assumptions about the world and about humanity, that we need to really ramp up our countercultural catechesis efforts, we might say.
How and why does woke ideology teach students to think of the world in systemic terms?
Right. That's a good question. I think part of it is that students are looking for meaning. As we said, as Weaver pointed out, there's a sense of meaninglessness and powerlessness. And this gives students a meaning. It gives them an easy lens through which to view the world, where everybody can be categorized systemically into this group or that group, right? We've got these easy identity markers. And so that really becomes a sort of an in with students who are struggling with a lack of meaning and purpose. This can give them that meaning.
Does it tie in then also to that personal agency and personal responsibility to say, well, the problem's in the system, not with me, or the problem's with the system, not with any particular individual. And so changing systems that are inherently racist, for instance, how do you change it without personal accountability?
Right, yes. So this idea of personal agency, I think, is one that we really need to focus on. What these woke approaches to the world do is they really make people into either the victim or the victimizer. And victimhood thinking may at first seem empowering because you have a target to be against. But at the same time, you're sort of outsourcing your own agency to the oppressor or to the victimizer because it's their fault. And you're stuck now again without agency because you're being acted upon by these systemic forces, by these systems that are corrupt, by these oppressors and powerful people. And if anything, students, everybody needs a sense of personal agency, that there is an actual impact and outcome to individuals' actions in the world.
Josh Pauling is our guest. We're talking about woke ideology in public schools. He's been teaching high school history for 13 years. He is head elder at All Saints Lutheran Church in Charlotte, North Carolina, and he's author of a recent column titled The Look of the Hunted in Today's U.S. High Schools. We'll discuss what's called constructivism and how it fits into this woke ideology on the other side of the break. Stay tuned.
Lutheranism in the public square. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Collinsville, Illinois is happy to support the Christ-centered, cross-focused ministry of Issues Etc. Join us for worship, Bible classes, youth ministry, and other opportunities to grow in Christ. We have a Christian day school for children in preschool to eighth grade. We are located at 1300 Beltline Road. Call us at 618-344-3151, or visit www.goodshepherdcollinsville.org.
How should Lutherans respond to the assertion, your church is too Catholic? Find out in Pastor Will Whedon's column in the latest Issues Etc. journal. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Joshua Pauling traces his path from big box evangelicalism and Reformed Calvinism to the treasures of historic Christianity found in the Lutheran Church, the free online Issues Etc. journal. We're discussing woke ideology in public schools with Josh Pauling. This is Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. In less than a week, we've already surpassed the 100 in-person attendance mark for the 2021 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. You can still register, and you should. If the in-person limit is increased, early registrants will get top priority. This year's speaking lineup includes Mark and Molly Hemingway, Brian Wolfmiller, Robert George, Larry Rast, and Will Whedon. Find out more and register at issuesetc.org or give us a call, 618-223-8385. The 2021 Making the Case Conference, Friday, July 23rd and Saturday, July 24th at Concordia University, Chicago. Josh, what is constructivism?
So constructivism plays a role in this too. And as an educator, constructivism is something that that we are taught very much in the college system. Most teacher education programs are really based on a constructivist view of knowledge and how students learn. So to put it simply, from an educational perspective, constructivism says that students construct their own knowledge, that knowledge is socially constructed. And so if that's how students learn, is by sort of constructing their own knowledge, that has a lot of impacts on how one thinks about the role of the teacher, what the teacher does, and also what the goal of education is. And you might trace this back to John Dewey and the rise of progressive education. Certainly there'd be many other influences as well on this, but I'll give you a reference. A prominent educational theorist in the 20th century, Maxine Green, she would put it this way, that the teacher must make it possible for students to create meanings in a cosmos devoid of objective meaning, to find reasons for being. Right, so that's constructivism in the educational realm, that teachers need to make it possible for students to create meanings in a cosmos devoid of meaning. And so there we see several things coming through, that there's no objective truth, right? And we're back to the meaninglessness that Weaver referenced years before. And from this perspective, truth, meaning, and reality aren't verifiably real, and certainly not revealed by God. Instead, they're things that are constructed by the individual student for the individual student.
How have these ideas entered and taken over our public school education? Was it from the top down? Are the teachers imbibing in this? Is it policy driven? How does it enter?
I think, honestly, it's a combination of a lot of things. But as a teacher, I'll speak from my perspective, that most of the educational training that teachers undergo is based from these assumptions of constructivism. And so if that's what teachers are learning in the university, then that's what they're going to start out their teaching career with. And so if students construct their own knowledge, and if that's what teachers are being taught in university, then the role of the teacher significantly changes. No longer is the teacher there to guide students into the true, the good, and the beautiful. But now the teacher is there to simply encourage students along. And there's actually a catchphrase that is very common in educational parlance, and it goes like this, that teachers need to move from being the sage on the stage to being the guide on the side, right? And I think that really captures what constructivism puts forward, that the teacher is not the sage on the stage. The teacher is not there to sort of tell the truth and lead students into truth. The teacher is there on the side. And this is a very ubiquitous concept. I just heard it quoted actually recently in one of our Zoom faculty meetings a few months ago. So it's almost sort of a form of enlightened posturing or postmodern signaling. So I think that really captures how it's maybe come into the system and taken over the system, is through the teaching programs and the assumptions that they're based on in constructivism.
So how does this constructivism actually shape the minds and the lives of public school students and make them ripe for all these woke ideologies?
Right. So if knowledge is constructed by the self in the classroom, then it makes students well ready for the identity categories that are so prevalent today, like race, gender, and sexuality. Right. If my knowledge I'm constructing in the classroom, it should not come as a surprise then that individual identity is being self-constructed outside the classroom as well. It's just sort of a, you know, one step further.
How has the student's sense of personal agency and independence been undermined in the classroom?
Right. So I think this relates to the victimhood concept I was mentioning earlier, that if we're viewing the world through these lens of power and oppressed and oppressor, then those who are in victim categories have really outsourced their agency to the oppressor, right? And they no longer have much control over themselves. If all of the problems of the world are outside of themselves in the system because of the oppressor or the victimizer, then this idea of personal responsibility really gets lost in the mix.
I know that it was true when my children were of high school age and even before. Why are students encouraged to nurture career aspirations almost from the very beginning of public education, above all other things?
Yeah, that's a great question, Todd. I think it's because there's really nothing left. If a public school can't engage in the deeper issues of life, then all we're left with is career and money. And that fits very nicely with the mainstream narratives that are so common and prevalent about the value of money. The mainstream narratives regarding feminism as well would fit into this. And so that's really all teachers can do in a public setting if they're trying to be neutral, is to basically encourage students to get good grades so they can make money and have a good career. But in reality, teachers really can't promise that anymore. There's no guarantee that one who gets a good grades in high school and a college degree will automatically get a good job. Now, maybe in Richard Weaver's day, in the post-war world with rising wages and growth economically, maybe those promises could be made back in his day when he wrote the book. But in our day, we can't make those promises. And I tell my students that straight out. Look, I'm not going to tell you you're going to make more money if you go to college. I can't guarantee you that one bit. And if we look at all the data about college students and they're struggling to make it into adulthood, that certainly backs up this point that the teachers really can't promise that anymore. And so that has a big impact on students. They've been trained to think through these career lenses, but then when they get out, many of them realize they've been sold a bill of goods. And I think especially with the COVID experience, I know several college students myself who graduated and now are struggling to find a job. And certainly there's a lot of factors there, and maybe COVID economic conditions have part of the blame there. But this dream that we've sold to students really isn't coming into reality for many of them. And we need to reframe things to really focus more on the deeper meanings of life. And as Christians, we're especially prepared for that with our concept of the importance of the family and the importance of children and really the three estates which God places us within, the family, the church, and society.
Do you think that today's students will eventually outgrow their woke indoctrination and reject its worldview?
That is the million-dollar question, Todd. Honestly, I'm afraid not for many of them. And this is sort of the classic question that many people have been thinking about for years, especially in relation to college campuses, and something that Rogers focused on and other people as well, that when people raise the alarm to what goes on college campuses, many times the response was, they're just not in college. And when they get older, they'll, adapt to the modern world when they get jobs and so forth. But instead, what we're seeing unfold, especially pretty pronouncedly in the last few years, is sort of the woke march through the institutions, where they've not changed their views, but instead have become more entrenched in their views, especially as they gain power in the workplace and in society. So I'm a bit concerned about that. I don't think most of them will outgrow this indoctrination, especially if we don't present them with viable alternatives. And I think that's especially where Christians have something to offer. We have a better way. I think sometimes we get so caught up in just saying no that we don't provide a more compelling and better yes. Right? We have something better to offer than wokeness. So I think that's maybe something that Christians should think more about.
What do students need to know in order to combat wokeness?
They need to know that it's based on a faulty view of the human person, that at its root, it's not in line with reality, that placing individuals into all of these identity categories, viewing the world through this lens of power, is a cynical, impossible way to live in the world. And in my piece about the look of the hunted, I mentioned that if you play this hunted game, eventually the ones that have the look of the hunted are now becoming the hunter. And so everybody's in these categories of hunted and hunter. It's an impossible world to live in, where you don't know who your enemies are, you don't know who your friends are, you can never trust anyone, and there's no transcendent truth or objective reality to bridge the gap. There's no shared humanity or common narrative to unite us. So students really need to know that this woke approach to the world is just not true, that there's a more complete view of the human person, and we need to recover that. We need to value each individual for their uniqueness, but also value our common and shared humanity. We need to celebrate the goodness of the human body and its gift of gender, right? All of these things that wokeness picks up on, we have answers to, and we just need to do a good job of making them compelling.
You mentioned the slow march through the institutions. Do you sense that this woke ideology has not only permeated the classroom, but perhaps also is seeking to permeate the sanctuary, the church?
Oh, definitely. You see this especially within evangelicalism and some of the tensions within evangelicalism about critical race theory and whether it should be utilized as a tool. The Southern Baptist Convention has had some struggles with that. So definitely, this is something that is not just outside the church. It is something that we all need to deal with and sort of wake up to. And you had Carl Truman on a few weeks ago regarding his new book, and I think that's a great resource for Christians especially to realize that this affects us too. We've imbibed the culture and much of these narratives in relation to how we think about ourselves, how we think about the individual and the human person. And we need to double down on our efforts to really catechize the whole human person within the Christian worldview. That is something that we need to strengthen.
In terms of the public schools, do you see a way forward? And if so, what is it? Or is it a lost cause?
Well, I've made my decision, so I've revealed my answer. This is my last year. Teachers, obviously, Christian teachers will make different decisions on that. But I do think it is getting harder and harder to make the good confession as a teacher. Certainly, I did not feel any pressure to leave or anything like that. My school has been wonderful, so I don't want to give the wrong impression that I'm being forced out or anything like that. My school has been a great place to work, and when I closed my classroom door, thankfully, I did still have freedom to address the issues I wanted to. But in my opinion, the writing's on the wall, and I think, you know, the time is coming where more people will be faced with a similar decision, whether it's in schools or in the workplace. And we need to prepare ourselves for that. I don't think there's any firm answers we can give. It is a matter of sort of personal conscience to a certain degree. But for me, the time has come. I don't really see the system improving. I think COVID as well has revealed a lot of the deep weaknesses of the system at large. And I don't see those problems going away. And so in my position, I'm just made the decision to look elsewhere.
Josh, you wrote the Wittenberg Trail feature for our latest Issues Etc. journal. Tell us about your column.
Yeah, so thank you for the opportunity for writing that column in the journal. Basically, I tell the story from evangelicalism to Reformed Seminary to confessional Lutheranism. That's sort of my journey in a nutshell. And it was lots of twists and turns along the way. But ultimately, what really convinced me of the truths of Lutheranism were its faithfulness to Scripture, the beauty of sacramental worship, and the objective nature of God's gifts for us as human persons.
Folks, you can subscribe absolutely free to the Issues Etc. journal. It's online and free. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, click the red subscription button, enter your email address, and we will send you the latest Issues Etc. journal. Josh Pauling has been teaching high school history for 13 years. He's head elder at All Saints Lutheran Church in Charlotte, North Carolina, and author of a recent column titled The Look of the Hunted in Today's U.S. High Schools. Josh, thanks.
Thank you, Todd.
Pastor Tom Baker will be with us on the other side of the break. We're going to be teaching a Sunday school lesson about Solomon building the temple.
We need people who are well-educated enough to know what the Constitution means, what it says, how its principles work.
Dr. Robert George of Princeton University talking about his presentation on the Constitution and civic virtue at this year's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
We need people who are willing to fight for those principles, to call out politicians, whether they're liberal or conservative, whether they are Democratic or Republican, when they transgress against the Constitution. We need a people who are fit for liberty and fit for the rule of law under a Constitution like ours, a Republican polity like ours, established under the Constitution. So I'm really going to be talking about civic virtue and its relationship to constitutional structures and principles.
You can meet and hear Dr. Robert George at the 2021 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, July 23rd and Saturday, July 24th at Concordia University, Chicago. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385.
Solid. Serious. Substantive. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Superstition is the belief that one event caused an unrelated event. It's often tied up with false beliefs about God and how he works in the world. Is there really such a problem with superstitions? Is there really such a problem with saying knock on wood or good luck? Explore this and more in the March issue of The Lutheran Witness. We will talk about scientism, superstition, New Age, and so much more. To order your copy, visit cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Many educational institutions are governed by the whims of culture and are increasingly hostile to the Word of God. In contrast, Faith Lutheran School in Plano, Texas, provides classical Lutheran education rooted in God's Word for students preschool through grade 12. Simply put, we equip students to stand firm in the faith through solid education focused on wisdom and virtue. We offer in-person instruction as well as live online classes for remote learning. To learn more, visit flsplano.org, flsplano.org.